top temperatures of 7 degrees in Shetland, 7 in Edinburgh. For a time during the evening, things will turn quieter, but then later as we go on through Wednesday night, we see yet more heavy rain arriving. Well, that's all the weather for now. It's back to you, Luke.
Ben, thank you. Now on Radio 4, we continue our Book of the Week, Return of a King, The Battle for Afghanistan by William Dalrymple. It's 1839. The British Army of the Indus has restored Shah Shuja to the throne in Kandahar, and following Dost Muhammad's surrender, they march into Kabul in triumph. But behind the scenes, all is not well. When an inebriated foreign soldier compromises a young Afghan girl, the seeds of revenge are sown. Despite this, Shuja now begins his reign, supported by the British envoy, Sir William McNaughton, and Sir Alexander Burns, his deputy. The reader is Tim Pigott-Smith.
Shah Shuja now announced to the nobility of Afghanistan a fresh start. He would forgive his enemies and honour his commitments to the British, who had looked after him when he had lost everything. Meanwhile, the British troops and sepoys wandered happily around the autumnal palace gardens and the Kabul orchards heavy with fruit. The narrow streets gave onto the mud-walled compounds of rich merchants and the townhouses of landowners and tribal chiefs. Between the great houses stretched miles of bustling brick-built bazaars arranged by trade, with separate streets for shawl merchants, the sellers of spice and rose water, and the importers of Bukhara silks, Russian tea, Chinese porcelain, and the celebrated stabbing daggers of Isfahan. After all the hardships they had been through, the British troops were enchanted. Mirza Atta wrote, "The proverb, the women of Kabul all have lovers, just as the wheat flour of Peshawar is all cut with maize flour, was also quickly proved as the soldiers rode the steed of their lust, unbridled, day and night." As late summer turned to autumn, and the nights began to grow longer and colder, the troops were issued with sheepskin clothes, warm gloves and quilts. Snipe and duck shooting became popular diversions, as did a little later skating and snowman building. "We enjoyed the winter as thoroughly as circumstances would permit," wrote Thomas Seton. "Shooting, snowballing, making snow giants, and picnics to the lake, for the weather was frequently most enjoyable. How clear, how blue, and how cloudless it was." Shuja, meanwhile, was busy rebuilding the Bala Hissar fort. The Mughal gardens were replanted, and a new harem sarai designed from scratch to be ready for his womenfolk when they arrived from India. The old offices of state were reinstated, and with them the elaborate uniforms which amazed British observers. "The court officials should really be viewed in a body of some hundreds," wrote the artist James Rattray, "dressed in crimson jackets and bearing on their heads their high, fantastic caps of every conceivable semblance." On the 2nd of November, 1839, with the puddles in the Kabul bazaars now iced over and frost glinting on the willows beside the river, Shah Shuja left to winter in Jalalabad. McNaughton went with him. On the last night of the year, as the winter cold grew more intense, Alexander Burns threw a hogmanay party and presided over it all in kilt and sporran. A young cavalry officer, Neville Chamberlain, up for the week from Kandahar, was one of the guests. "We had a very merry party," he wrote the following morning, "though we had nothing to drink but brandy and gin. At about 2 in the morning we took to the mess tables and commenced dancing reels. Captain Sinclair standing on the table, dressed in the Highland costume, playing the bagpipes." Yet there were shadows. One regiment returning to India had its rear guard ambushed and massacred as it descended the Khyber Pass. At the same time, a senior officer was murdered while out walking in Wadak. He had disobeyed orders and strayed from the road to chat with some Afghans on a hill. They cut him to pieces. By the winter of 1839-40, the idea of permanently annexing Afghanistan was being discreetly discussed. Such overconfidence soon began to lead to a series of major strategic errors. Firstly, rather than concentrating on consolidating Shah Shuja's fragile rule in Afghanistan, India's Governor-General Lord Auckland, like more recent invaders, took the premature view that the conquest was already complete, and so allowed himself to be distracted by launching another war of aggression in a different theatre. "China promises to be amusing," wrote his sister Emily in a revealingly flippant letter around this time. By withdrawing a large part of the Bombay army from Afghanistan, Auckland ensured that Macnaghten would never have the troops or the money he would need to make Shah Shuja's rule a success. To make matters worse, the Afghan sense of honour was now seriously offended by the growing number of affairs taking place between British officers and Afghan women. But the most visible activity was certainly in Kabul, where a flourishing prostitution racket quickly sprang up to service the needs of all the single soldiers lodged around the town. "The English drank the wine of shameless immodesty," wrote Mirza Atta, "forgetting that any act has its consequences and rewards, so that after a while, the spring garden of the king's regime was blighted by the autumn of these ugly events." Among those taking full advantage of the opportunities offered by Kabul was Alexander Burnes himself. Given that Macnaghten in Jalalabad was daily taking over more of the duties of government, Burnes found himself with time on his hands. "I lead, however, a very pleasant life," he wrote to one friend, "and if rotundity and heartiness be proofs of health, I have them. Breakfast I have long made a public meal. Covers are laid for 8, and half a dozen officers drop in as they feel disposed to discuss a rare Scotch breakfast of smoked fish, salmon gills, devils and jellies, and puff away at their cigars until 10. If Afghan gossip was anything to go by, devils and jellies were by no means the limit of his pleasures. Burnes was especially shameless, believed Mirza Atta. In his private quarters, he would take a bath with his Afghan mistress in the hot water of lust and pleasure, as the two rubbed each other down with flannels of giddy joy and the talc of intimacy. A growing number of Afghan women seemed to have made themselves available for a short but profitable ride into the cantonment. This became so common that the British began to compose rhymes about the easy availability of Afghan women. "A Kabul wife under burqa cover was never known without a lover." In March 1840, Shah Shuja returned to Kabul from his winter quarters. With Dost Muhammad now immured within a Bukhara dungeon, Shah Shuja and his backers had a real opportunity to consolidate their joint rule. At the same time, a growing realization began to spread that it was Macnaghten, not Shuja, who was really running the new regime. The first point of dissension was a growing disagreement over the army. Already aware of the massive cost of defending Afghanistan, and of the way it was beginning to turn a small profit in the East India Company's account into a large loss, Auckland was under strict instructions from London to train up in Afghanistan an efficient Afghan national army. In Kabul, Shuja was all too aware that Macnaghten's strategy of diverting resources from the old tribal cavalry levies towards a professional standing infantry army removed his principal means of extending patronage to the chiefs. Macnaghten was taking away Shah Shuja's only real opportunity to reward his nobility for their support and undermining the power and wealth of his most important followers. Shuja himself was unclear if a British-trained, British-officered army would ever actually be obedient to him. "I am not personally acquainted with many of the officers in the force," he wrote. "They do not even seem to know that they are my soldiers." It was in 1840, just as he began to feel his grip on power slipping, that we read reports of grand perorations of the king and his court around Kabul and its vicinity. "The wild grandeur of Shuja's company baffles description," wrote the artist James Rattray. "In front come the royal dromedaries, with bells suspended from their harness, ringing in time to their dreamy gait, with outstretched necks, tasseled and ornamented. There were hundreds of them. Many bore small cannon, which the camel drivers fired at random. After them pranced a squadron of the envoy's bodyguard, in blue and silver, and then majesty itself." The Shah was a man of great personal beauty. The character of his countenance was one of excessive hauteur blended with melancholy, an expression which was increased tenfold by his regularly marked eyebrows, long dark eyes, and beard of jettiest black. Rattray was dazzled. As the royal train swept on through the narrow winding streets, every window, doorway and roof was crowded with spectators. But they were not cheering the man they called the Firangi's king. Instead, they showed no sign of pleasure or loyalty, but merely looked on, mute and dogged, counting their beads as they stood motionless, with arms crossed over their breasts. But the biggest problem of all, as Macnaghten was frank enough to recognise, was simply the growing taint to Shuja's reputation brought by his continued association with the infidel British and the growing conviction that he was merely their puppet. The difference of our religion is, of course, the chief cause of antipathy on the part of the people, Macnaghten wrote to Auckland. The Afghans are a nation of bigots. While Macnaghten was correct to point to the religious difference, he was wrong to interpret their objection as mere bigotry. The mullahs grew in time to have good reason to dislike a regime which only intermittently patronized their institutions or helped restore their mosques, and which seized for itself many of their endowments to help augment the regime's tax revenues. It was around this time that the more perceptive of the British in Afghanistan began to realize the very delicate nature of their position and the fragility of the regime they had installed. Meanwhile, General William Knott, the officer commanding Kandahar, blamed Macnaghten and his political advisers. "We are hated by the people, and unless several regiments be quickly sent, not a man will be left to note the fall of his comrades." The first signs of concerted armed resistance took place in May 1840, when a column marching from Kandahar towards Ghazni Fort was attacked by 2,000 horsemen of the Ghilzai tribe. The Ghilzai were quickly driven off, leaving 200 dead behind them. But they learned the lesson that a frontal attack in flat, open country was not the way to tackle the British. Then, in mid-August, less than a year after Shah Shuja had entered Kabul in triumph, news arrived in the capital of exactly what the British had most dreaded. Amir Dost Muhammad had been sprung from his Bukhara dungeon, and reports began to arrive that the Amir had returned to northern Afghanistan and raised the flag of holy war. It had taken just a year for the Afghans to rise in revolution, but the jihad against the British had now begun.
Return of a King, The Battle for Afghanistan by William Dalrymple was read by Tim Piggott-Smith, abridged by Libby Spurrier and produced by Joanna Green. It's a peer production for BBC Radio 4. Now, time for the shipping forecast, issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on today, Wednesday, the 30th of January. There are warnings of gales in all areas except Trafalgar. The general synopsis at 1800, low Bailey 955, expected just north of Viking 961 by 1800 on Wednesday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Southwest Viking, southwesterly, veering westerly, gale 8 to storm 10, rain or squally showers, moderate or poor. Northeast Viking, north at Cirra, southeasterly 7 to severe gale 9, veering southwesterly, gale 8 to storm 10, rain or squally showers, moderate or poor. South at Cirra, southeasterly, veering southwesterly, 6 to gale 8, rain then showers, good, occasionally poor. Forties, Cromarty 4th, southwest 7 to